to us in October with the recommendation. So with that, I would ask that the board approve that nomination committee. Motion by Regent Ridley. Seconded by Regent Ritchie. Any further discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes. Thank you, David, Cynthia, and Tamla for doing that. The next item is give you an update on our prospects of board training. With the help of Julia McDonald, we have been in contact with AGB, the Association of Governing Boards. We had a conference call yesterday afternoon with those folks. They are proposing a training session for us on October 27th in the afternoon. We're still working on a time frame. I took the liberty of saying that we would sort of adapt to their recommendation. 2 hours is probably not enough. It may be a 3 or 4 hour session, but I think it's critical that we make effective any ability to meet and get training as a board. And so details will be forthcoming. At one time, they had indicated the possibility that they would conduct a phone interview with each of us. I don't know where that stands now that they've assigned it to a specific consultant, who is Carol Cartwright. She is a former president, now president emeritus of Kent State. She served in that position from 1991 to 2006. President Ransdell, do you know her?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
So, good. Barbara?
Yeah.
So that is the folk that the consultant they are proposing, and unless, you know, President Ransdell or Regent Birch for some reason think we may not want to use that person, we'll probably proceed along those lines.
Excellent choice.
Good. Good. We will have training. We haven't had a formal training in some time. We've had bits and pieces, but this will be an opportunity to look at some of our practices. As part of that, and this sort of leads into the next item, as part of that process, they will, if we want, look at our bylaws and make any recommendations for modernization, tweaking, what have you. That has been thrown out as something that we would want to do. Dr. Capps has indicated to me that he's got a couple of suggestions that he would like to propose to us. So we will start that process, let you be aware that we're going to be looking at the bylaw situation. But that, you know, that's a little lesser of a priority for us than trying to get a full formal board training in place. So if you would mark your calendar for October 27th on the afternoon. Time, I don't know, but let's prepare for the worst. Let's say 4 hours. We will have some type of social function afterwards where your spouse or significant other will join us and have an opportunity to share some time. And I understand that the consultant would be available to be accessible with us as well. So follow-up questions or whatnot would be in place. So what I would like to conclude with is at this point, if you want to put it in a formal motion to allow me to structure a bylaw committee at some point down the road when we start gathering information, great. If you want to just kind of put this on the back burner for another meeting or two until we actually get materials in front of us, that's great too. But at some point we would like to have an ad hoc committee on the bylaws in place, and we'll take a look at what the board might want to do. Understand that it takes a two-thirds vote and two readings to do that. So, you know, the process will take some time, and we'll proceed accordingly. So I don't know that we need to officially form a bylaw committee today. If you want to, we can. If not, just be aware that it will be forthcoming.
So I think it would be prudent for you to form a committee as soon as you're comfortable in doing so, simply because if you were going to make any bylaw changes, you'd like to not make them. I mean, you'd like to do them between now and the spring, end of the spring. So,
is that a motion? Raise your birch, is that a motion?
Sure.
I thought so, but I have one. Okay.
Second,
we have a motion by Regent Birch and a second by Regent Ridley. Any questions or discussions on that particular item? If not, we'll call for a vote for the approval of setting up a bylaw committee at the appropriate time to assess bylaws. All in favor, aye. Opposed, no. The passes. At this point, that's my report. That should bring you up to date. We'll next turn the meeting over to Chair Bell of the Academic Affairs Committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we have a set of action items, although very important, and recognizing some of our faculty for maritime status. Provost Lee is probably lurking behind me somewhere.
Thank you very much, Bill. It is always a particular pleasure for me to present faculty members for consideration by you all for merit status. Invariably, these are folks who have served the institution, served our students in some important and significant ways over a long period of time. And it's wonderful seeing you see this. And we have a pretty large number this morning. We have six, which is more than probably we usually bring at one time. The first is from Gordon Ford College of Business, Dr. Jerry Gottlieb. Jerry was a member of the Department of Marketing for a good quarter of a century, and over the course of that time, he did a lot to lay the foundation of our modern curriculum. He taught some very tough courses in some very demanding ways. And his students talk extensively about what they took away from his classes and how they how that has continued to shape their careers as they move forward. But he was a very important senior faculty leader in that department for a very long time. From Ogden College of Science and Engineering, Dr. Keith Andrew from the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Keith was an outstanding researcher. He landed a good many grants. He was department head for over a decade. He was president of the Kentucky Association of Physics Teachers, and he continues to be such a valuable presence on this campus. He's a member of the WKU Research Foundation. We're in the process of conducting a search for an associate provost in research and creative activity, and we've asked Keith to come out of retirement to join that search committee. And I think he's going to be a very valuable presence, not only as an active researcher, but somebody who sees these things from a perspective of a department head. In the Department of Agriculture, Dr. Charles Anderson, the man who really brought our equine program into being on this campus. As your notes say, when he started some 40 years ago, we had six horses and basically no facilities. And now we have a small herd of 30 to 40. We have wonderful facilities, and Charles was very important in establishing the writing team on this campus. So it really set in motion something that has a lot of long-term significance for our students and for our ag program. Dr. Jim Martin, also from the Department of Agriculture, and particularly important with our horticulture program. Jim was very significant in terms of gardens, and I don't mean gardens like what I've got in my backyard. I mean gardens like what folks travel the world to see. And his contribution was not only to horticulture, but he was an important pioneer in our study abroad efforts and one of the early folks on this campus to say that part of your preparation as an undergraduate and as a graduate student is to have an international experience, to see how the rest of the world works. And Jim was a very important early champion of that, in addition to his work specifically in the horticulture program. From Potter College of Arts and Letters, John Hageman from the Department of English. John has a special distinction and a warm place in my heart. He is Potter College's only million-dollar man. We recognize folks who achieve $1 million in terms of grants, and that's tougher to do in some colleges, like in the College of Arts and Letters. And John is the only faculty member in Potter College who has ever landed a total of $1 million in grants over the course of his career. And all of that went to help our students become better writers. Part of the National Writing Project, the WKU Writing Project, he worked every summer with elementary and secondary teachers to strengthen their writing skills, which they brought into classrooms really all over the Commonwealth. But John has made an important contribution, a very important contribution, to strengthening a basic academic skill, writing, as it's taught literally from first grade right up through through graduate school. And finally, Dr. Cassandra Pennick from the philosophy program in the Department of Philosophy and Religion. Dr. Pennick taught a number of things, but if you were to just sort of tap a student and say, what did Dr. Pennick teach, they'd say she taught logic. And they'd say she taught logic with a vengeance. She, a very sharp and incisive mind, and she brought that into the classroom and did a wonderful job of conveying particularly logic to our undergraduate students so well that the computer science folks in pre-law made logic a course that they particularly wanted their students to take. And to give you an indication of how smart Cassandra is, as soon as she taught her last class here at WKU, she moved promptly to Hawaii and has lived happily ever after. But I'm delighted to recommend all six of these for your consideration for emeritus status. I don't think any of them are here this morning, but I would like to recommend all of them for emeritus status.
Very nice report. So this is an action item for the academic committee, so I will entertain a motion to approve. Barbara, Tamla, second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. David, that was a great report. Thank you. And I would request, and I think I've said this before, if any of them are available to come to the meeting when we actually recognize them, that would be great. It's a treat, I think, for all of us whenever we have a student being recognized or a faculty member, because yes, they are the heart and soul of our university. So,
and we did invite them for this morning, but I will also re-invite them for the regular
and
meeting.
I'm here. I don't know about the others.
Oh,
great.
My apologies.
No, that's fine.
Charles,
you're busy. I understand.
Well, and I also don't see as well as I once did. So,
I understand that too.
Charles Anderson from the equine program in the Department of Agriculture.
Morning.
I can remember when we didn't have many horses, and one of Charles's major points as to why we should have horses was to prove that we were losing students who didn't come here because they didn't want to come where they couldn't ride their horses and sometimes bring their horses. And so he was arguing retention and recruitment in order to get horses, and he did it well.
The equipment that eats always makes me nervous, though. You know?
If Dr. Pennick were closer, we would bring her to as many meetings as we could and add logic to things. But our next items on the committee are informational items. And, David, I think you have some people here to talk about some of these things.
Yes, an enrollment report is often a part of committee meetings as well as a regular board meeting, and particularly with the fall semester underway. Dr. Brian Meredith, our Chief Enrollment and Graduation Officer, has an update on where we are on enrollment for this fall.
Thank you, Provost. Good morning, everybody. We're back before you again to talk about the always ever popular topic of enrollment. We talked with a group of outside constituencies yesterday about some initiatives, and I always start out, like I do with you all on the board, that the enrollment management landscape and shoreline is ever-changing and always so, so very organic. And you all have heard me use that line before, but it's very true an accurate description of where EEM is. But just kind of talking you through preliminary data, we're here in late September. And the reason I say preliminary data for enrollments, because October 25th is the census when we formally turn into CPE, our final enrollment numbers. Just giving you some talking points, and I believe coming around to you is the preliminary data enrollment update. Compared to the same time last year, we're slightly up in first-time, first-year students, freshmen, as well as new transfers, and that's the second year that we've seen that. Those aren't large numbers, but it is an uptick and showing momentum in a positive way. The transfers there, it's really is a shining star, and in those schools, SkyCTC and Owensboro are really driving some of that in our 11 joint admissions partners. We were worried going into the summer, into the late spring, how dual credit would be, and I believe Dr. Lavis's team, Laura and Delaine, are here behind me, and they'll mention some of that here at the next reporting. But we're up in dual credit students, over 339 students, about 18.5%, which is a positive element, and that feeds our enrollment long term as well as our overall enrollment profile, and you'll get more of that here in the upcoming presentations. But some of the upticks with this freshman class growth and transfer growth really do indicate that the strategies for recruiting traditional students, revamping scholarships, communications, you name it, the admissions office has totally been reorganized and re-energized with Dr. Lux's leadership. We're really proving very positive measures. None of these things happen overnight very quickly. Just to give you some tidbits on the class as it is today or this week, by the way, we're at 20,068 this week. Very similar to where we were this week in September as far as that overall number for fall 16. That could and will change as we get closer to October 25th, the census date. But let me speak to you about the class a minute and then the overall student body, and then we'll come back around. The incoming class this time right now has an average ACT of 23, which is slightly above Kentucky's average of 20. The GPA has improved to 3.27. We were at 3.1 in fall of 12. It's rising each consecutive year, so we're bringing in more qualified, academically qualified students. This is an important point. 48% of our first-time freshmen, and not all these stats are on the document you have, they're earning college credit before they ever touch a foot here on the Hill. And that's moving them through categories faster through the freshman, sophomore, and junior categories. And that changes and kind of grays the dynamic of categories of freshman and sophomore. But that's a good problem to have. That means our students are coming to us with more AP dual credit hours. Incoming class is represented from 27 states and over 21 countries. That's an improvement and showing that our undergraduate admissions recruitment footprint has expanded. For years, we stayed close to Kentucky or the states contiguous to Kentucky, and the admissions team, you know, they're all across the U.S., Texas, Florida, California these days, and expanded that recruitment footprint, and you'll continue to see that happening. Diversity remains high in this incoming class. 21% of those students are reporting race. Identifying as students of color, African Americans remain high at about 13.3%, up about 14% overall. That's the incoming class. It's not the overall student body. The demographics of the student body, just to mention a few of these things, we're still honoring our stewardship to the Commonwealth of Kentucky. 77% are in-state, underrepresented minorities, about 15%. And 11% African-American. Again, that's the overall student body at WKU. 48 states are represented currently. South Dakota and Montana we're missing out on, but Dr. Ranzel promised me he's going to put a big red coat on and head to South Carolina or South Dakota and help us recruit there. 86 countries in our international student population. It's a pretty big footprint for our global initiatives. Even with international slightly dipping down, and I'll talk more about that in a second, 86 countries is a very strong representation of the class. These points are kind of lost sometimes in an enrollment presentation, but not lost at CPE and the state level. Preliminary data at this point shows WKU's graduation rate highest ever. The four-year graduation rate is at about 30%. six-year graduation rate's almost 52 at 51.6%. We're moving students to commencement faster, getting them either into graduate school or out there in the working world, and that's a positive thing. The joint admissions, of which several years ago a lot of folks questioned whether we should be doing joint admissions. In the market today, we absolutely must be involved in that in our 11 joint admission agreements here in Kentucky, and then Ball State and Tennessee and Ivy Tech and Indiana are paying off. There are over 800 students that are currently enrolled with our joint admissions program, and that's helping will drive some of those transfer numbers. You still see on the data report here that was passed around to you that the national trend is consistent. We're down in males versus female students. That's nothing new. Undergraduate representation, I would say, is flat. Slight's a small downtick there. But first-time, first-year freshman is up. Again, those are not large numbers, but up is better than where we were 3 years ago with this and is incrementally stepping it up. Dual credit, I mentioned earlier, growing even with the state's question marks on how that was going to work coming out of Frankfurt, that thus growing. And dual credit will feed our overall enrollment in time as we cultivate and admissions work with those students. Backside of the document, just representing the transfer students, KCTCS, even though their enrollment is significantly down, economy stronger, community college enrollment dives traditionally across the country, but our relationships with our joint admission partners are proving positive. The sky, as you would imagine, here locally and in Owensboro are driving some of our most positive aspects of the transfer enrollment. These others are majors. These shouldn't surprise you, but nursing, management, and org lead on the graduate side are really remaining very strong. I mentioned on the top right, international had taken a slight dip. We anticipated that. You may say, well, slight, it's negative 200, but some schools across the country are seeing a 50 and 60% decrease in their international students. We're maintaining a little over 1,100 international students, and again, that's because of the investment of time and resources and people and the infrastructure to support our internationals, and we're expanding into new markets there, so I don't think you're going to see that stay there for long is my prediction on that one. We laid out the counties. Warren County, lots of competition coming into Warren County. Although we have tenfold ramped up our activities here in Warren County in recruiting of the students, and we're still working with that very closely with admissions. But even Tennessee, going down into our leading states, Tennessee, Indiana, and Illinois, competing with the Hope and all the scholarship opportunities that the governor in Tennessee has put forth, we're still holding our own. And you see the countries, top five countries driving us here. The non-traditional number, again, and you've heard Dr. Ransdell mention this before and possibly even me, as the economy improves, these folks are going back to work. That's what's happening there. That is a very quick run-through of where we are. We will get to October 25th, which is the census date, which is traditionally the fall board meeting. And usually we're a day off, if not hit the exact census date, when we give you those final numbers. They're pretty solid within 24 hours of that meeting, going into that meeting. These numbers will change. You say, well, why will they change here at late September? One, on demand, students can register there. Second, by term, they can register there. That's all on the positive side. On the less than positive side, students, if they cannot connect, figure out their financials, that could also impact it on a less than positive manner too. So I don't want to paint a picture for you that we cannot produce in October, but the EM division, and for that matter across the campus, is working very hard to make sure those students are settled and have financial plans to keep them here on the Hill. Retention is a piece or an initiative that we've not taken our eyes off of and will not. I used to say it's a new frontier. It is the ongoing frontier for us. We feel that we've stayed the fall with the new students, new freshmen and transfers, investing a lot of time and resources into that, revamping ARC, making sure the early alert systems are in there, trying to get our academic advisors in that central, and I say ARC, that's our Academic Advising and Retention Center, making sure they have the resources they need to help the students transition and stay in not just do score scheduling, do more of a holistic advising model with the students, not just picking times and days. One thing we've implemented just in the last few days or put into motion to happen is a college scheduler piece. It is an app. It's one of many things I could list for you, but the app which will, and the students like using apps, as you will understand, that's the nature of the student body we're working with today, for that matter. All of us like that to a certain extent. But the app will feed the students information in timely manners. Are you taking the right courses to stay on your degree path? Or, you know, if you take this course, it's going to get you off your four-year degree path. There's a litany of services tied to that app, and that will allow our academic advisors within the center to spend more time, you know, saying, well, Jay Todd, what's your long-term goals here, and how can we get you holistically having that conversation, which will feed retention. A lot going to retention, you know, is like turning an aircraft carrier. That doesn't just happen overnight. And it will, it's beyond just EM. EM has to be the voice for it, but it's a campus initiative, and academic affairs and Dr. Lee and the deans and others have been very supportive, and we're just going to have to continue to push in that direction. That's really a Cliff Notes version of where we are here this Friday. And we'll come back to you in October and tell you the final number sent to CPE. Yes, ma'am.
Just a comment. First of all, I think the overall numbers, if you look at what's happening to everybody else across the country,
yes,
they're pretty remarkable.
We're holding our own.
This is pretty good.
Yes.
Because everybody else is beginning to see a downturn for a while. One of the things that would be interesting, not for us necessarily, but for you, more and more, since we've had fewer hours that students can require for degree, students have to know almost what they're going to do the day they walk in, or they're going to be here longer. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious as to whether or not we'd get any clues about whether or not our majors are as aligned as they need to be. Over the years, more and more majors offer interdisciplinary electives. I'm just wondering, on here you see in the top five a couple of ones that are trending down. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what's trending up and whether there are any messages in there for what my data sent our recruiting. Just that kind of question. I'm assuming you all are looking at
That's a good question. Let me go back to Dr. Birch's first comment that we are holding our own, and I realize that's a relative statement because its numbers are all relative, but many schools are not seeing, they're seeing significant, you know, 4%, 5%, and 7% loss on student enrollment. We're not there. We aren't at that stage. But to circle back to Regent Birch's comment is very important. ARC and the advisors are talking with us about making sure that we are aligning majors and making students aware of some of the majors that we have out there as alternatives, particularly if a student goes through, say, nursing, which is a very popular major and usually has students waiting in line to get into that program. If for some reason that doesn't work out or is not a good personal fit for them, the transitional advisor model will help find them another place, a landing place academically, so they can succeed and go out and possibly still remain in public health at some level. You know, we have a diversity of majors. I don't hear students when we sit down and recruit them saying, oh, I wished you had. I mean, we've got a pretty long and lengthy inventory of academic majors, concentrations, and such out there for the students. But those are conversations that need to be ongoing, because if the institutions aren't aligning for the needs of the students to put them into the careers or in graduate school, then that does present another retention issue. But I believe we're in good shape with that. Can we improve that? Certainly. We just need to follow and track it, and we are here with education and management and some of the others. There's a lot of competition out there, particularly on the education side these days, those with the proprietary schools.
Amazing. We're up in Tennessee, mm-hmm, with all the, and yet we're down a little in Warren County. Mm-hmm.
Jason and I made a whirlwind.
Is it mostly adults?
Yeah. The Warren and Barron County, I think, are mostly adults. You correlate the Warren County, Barron County with that non-traditional at the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
I'm speculating, but I think there's a pretty direct correlation there. And again,
that would be interesting.
Improved economy and
We've traveled each year to the surrounding states, and Jason and I were in Tennessee in about 16 or 18 schools over the last 2 weeks, high schools. I don't know that I've ever received such a positive feedback from the guidance counselors and principals in the schools. We presented scholarship programs to them, the opportunities, the reciprocal county agreements on tuition, tip counties. It was one of the best I've seen in 6 years. They're looking for alternatives for their students, and Middle Tennessee is a great opportunity for us because they can go away but still quickly be back home, which is a desire of many. And the principals and guidance counselors, I mean, we have tours lined up out the wazoo from those visits. So usually it's just a cultivating relationship, but we had a lot of takeaways from those visits where we now will go forward and see if we can solidify that deal and bring them to the Hill.
David and Brian and I received a report a few weeks ago from our international enrollment management staff on our international recruitment strategy going forward. Very impressive, very thorough. And we just need to give them a little bit of time to put it in gear, and I think that bodes well for the future. I'm pleased to see our Saudi numbers holding strong. Boy, most of the universities that have significant Saudi populations have taken a big hit. We're holding firm, relatively so there. From a financial standpoint, we'll come back to you at the October 28 full board meeting with a correlation of the final census number and revenue, and how that will affect our financial profile for the balance of this fiscal year.
I think it is worth noting the proprietary competition out there. I know the University of South New Hampshire, I believe, which is actually a proprietary school, is one of the fastest growing universities in the country. And when you look at how bricks and mortar universities are going to survive and hopefully thrive, it's relationships. And so I think that comes back to your comment about advising and building a strong advising. And again, it speaks to our faculty. Those student-faculty relationships are going to make the difference, I think, for a lot of universities, is whether they we're not hoping for a recession so we can get more students. We're hoping for better retention and those kind of relationships that send students on to successful careers. So any other comments?
The at-risk institutions right now primarily are the small privates and for different reasons.
And we've seen that right here in Kentucky.
Yes, we have.
A handful of them going under. All right. Well, thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Dr. Bell.
Mr. Provost, we're going to talk a little bit about dual credits, I think, first.
We're going to talk a bit about dual credit, yes. And Brian made reference to it. This is a very important initiative on our campus over a long period of time, and the links with the schools and a kind of fast start for degree completion in a good time frame is very important dimensions for us. It's increasingly important discussion at the state level as well. I think your materials say that Beth Lavis will be doing this presentation. Beth is doing a presentation to the Council on Post-Secondary Education this morning on a matter that is very important to this institution, but she is there. But we have an ace pinch hitter in Laura Rickey, who is the Director of Academic Outreach in the Division of Extended Learning and Outreach, and Dwayne Neely, who is directly responsible for dual credit, is also here. So, Laura?
Thank you. We were really excited to have been extended this invitation to talk with you today and provide an update on WKU dual credit. Provost mentioned Dwayne Neely. I wanted to introduce him to you. He's the program manager, and he's been with DLO since 2005 and works in between our high schools and our WK academic units to coordinate an increasing number of dual credit opportunities for high school students. On your handout, you'll see this graphic that demonstrates that significant level of growth that we've seen, both in terms of the number of students participating and the credits that they're earning while they're high school students. This growth is reflective of the just immense amount of interest in dual credit from high school administrators, high school students and their families, even our Kentucky legislators. Increasingly, each session, you'll see that they're sponsoring and debating and passing bills to support dual credit at the high school level. And, you know, this growth is really a reflection of the broad base of support dual credit enjoys at WKU. Our administrative offices are always there to support new things that we either decide to do ourselves or are given to us to do. And our academic units, each college participates and offers some of their general education courses through dual credit, as well as some introductory courses to their disciplines. We have over 40 faculty across campus who are directly working with dual credit in mentoring and liaison roles with the high school teachers who are qualified to be WKU part-time faculty. The faculty work with them to ensure that the course taught at the high school has the same learning outcomes and rigor as the course would have on our campus. So our unit is always trying to create and support new avenues of opportunity to meet this level of demand for dual credit. And I wanted to just highlight a few of those initiatives outside of classes offered at the high school that we've worked on. Dr. Sally Ray has a lot of interest in dual credit and established the Hilltopper Institute there at WKU Glasgow. The campus hosts high school seniors to come there and sit with degree-seeking students in the classes and in lieu of taking classes at their high school. And last year we had 70 students who participated. And based upon what I'm seeing so far from fall, that number is going to increase this year, and the people, students taking advantage of that opportunity at Glasgow. One area that just enjoys a lot of robust demand in dual credit are our online courses. Each semester, Duane works to expand the number of courses that we offer, the number of sections in our popular courses, but we have to close registration prior to the deadline because we just reach our capacity. And that fulfills a unique niche for some students who otherwise wouldn't have access to dual credit as high school students. We serve homeschool students this way. We serve a lot of students that are attend small high schools where there's just not a significant number of students where the high school can set aside a period, a class period during the school day to offer a dual credit class. And also some of our students, even when there is dual credit at the high school, they just have a schedule that precludes them from enrolling in that dual credit course at their high school. So once again this fall, we've just seen a huge surge in the number of online dual credit opportunities. And then one of the most fun and innovative avenues that Duane worked to provide is he partnered with our Study Away office to offer a summer travel course for dual credit students. The students could enroll in either theater appreciation or economics, and they started working with their professor online, and then they deepened their learning and added relevance to it with experiences in New York City. And we're currently getting the word out about offering that opportunity again this summer for high school students. I'm real excited about that. We had just really great feedback on the students' experience in that program. Our office has always worked to support our high schools in being able to ensure access to dual credit courses, and even when families weren't prepared financially for that. When the high school allowed their high school teacher to teach one of our courses, we set aside a portion of that tuition into an allocation fund that they could then use to scholarship the student or perhaps by textbooks, lab materials, other things that supported their dual credit effort at their high school. But this year, you may have heard, our governor has appropriated $7.5 million that will go to school districts for them to be able to scholarship dual credit courses for their students. We're really excited about this and looking forward to how that develops. As part of that initiative by the state, they required post-secondary institutions who wanted to participate to cap their tuition, so the cost of dual credit this year is even lower. We were at $70 a credit hour previously for several years, and this year it's $52. And we've been asked to index ourselves to a third of the KCTCS credit hour rate moving forward. I think one of WKU's great strengths is our ability to be nimble and innovative. And as an example, when this program was announced by the governor, within hours, President Ransdell, Provost Lee started communicating with Dr. Lavis and our team about this opportunity. And President Ransdell was actually the first president to contact the governor and say, hey, WKU, we're in. And as a result of that, when the governor made the announcement in Russell Springs, we got a shout out. We were the only school mentioned by name that would be participating. And in the audience was the school administrators from Pulaski County. Well, they contacted Duane the next week and said, hey, well, we'd like to talk to you about offering WKU dual credit courses in our school. And that's pretty normal for us. Every year we spread the red, so to speak, on this map and extend the number of school districts and high schools that we're partnering with to bring dual credit course opportunities for their students. In addition to Pulaski County, this fall, Hancock, Green, and Taylor were added as partnering school districts with WKU for dual credit. And this is a really wonderful opportunity for our university to introduce the university to high school students and start to establish that relationship. All of the studies nationwide show that dual credit opportunities lead to higher rates of matriculation to post-secondary ed, as well as success once they're students in terms of retention and graduation rates. So as we increase that swath of red across the state, we are able to increase the number of relationships we can have with our high school students to talk about opportunities for them to earn their degree at WKU. That was the end of my information, but I'd love to answer any questions you might have about the program.
I think you did an able job of filling in, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jay Todd?
Sir, thank you so much for coming to present to us. I wanted to make a comment that I am a product of dual credit. I went to Barron County High School. Between AP courses and dual credit, I entered WKU with 27 credit hours, which isn't Gatton's 60, but 27 helped me out a whole lot. I did have two questions. I don't know if you'd have the statistics for. What is the average number of credit hours a student enters a public university with through WKU dual credit?
We're seeing about 7 point something as the average across the high school seniors who matriculate.
And do most students who take WKU dual credit end up coming to WKU? Is there a particular incentive? Assuming that students who do who take dual credit courses can use those credits and go to another public university in Kentucky, that is correct.
Yes.
And is there a particular incentive to encourage them to come to WKU?
Well, of course, they already have their transcript is sitting here, and they've started to form some relationships with faculty and departments and WKU KU in general. They have the option of getting a student ID. In fact, we've had a lot of calls this week about getting their ID so that they can go to the football game Saturday, which is a benefit of part-time students that dual credit students enjoy as well. About it fluctuates from year to year, but we about 50% of the students who take a dual credit course matriculate to WKU as a degree seeking student. And in recent years, the attention that the Office of Admission and Public Affairs has spent communicating in a direct way with our dual credit students has increased, and we're likely to see that rating increase as well as we can provide more information to students about how their interests align with opportunities for them at WKU and their career goal.
Thank you.
Is that an opportunity where if we had a more robust advising army that we could maybe do more advising to those?
Yeah, students? That's interesting that you would say that, because the state focused on that as well when they rolled out the scholarship plan, was making sure that students received advisement about, you know, what this meant when you sign up for dual credit. That, you know, you're really a college student, and this is, you're making a commitment that lasts. You know, it's not a temporary thing. You're establishing a transcript with the university. So that started. We have a person in our office who works directly with students to talk to them about that. But that's another reason that our faculty I was talking about who participate, we talk with them about how this is a great opportunity to introduce your major opportunities available in your department, in your college, to your future students. But certainly, advisement is key, and we could always do a better job of linking our potential students to them.
I understand. Say that what we're starting to do is a more direct link with enrollment management and these students, or is that something we have in place?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. Increasingly, the past few years, President Ransdell has mailed a letter to the home. We've had some direct communications like postcards and emails go to students and parents. Social media has been used to invite dual credit students to campus for events. So we've been partnering as far as reaching the students that are enrolled in dual credit with enrollment management types of initiatives like that.
There are students now, but that does not necessarily mean they'll be our students full time when they make their college choice. And so, yeah, this, now that we're 2,500 moving toward 3,000, it's a significant recruitment population for us, and we have to make the assumption that if we don't make sure they come here, they'll go somewhere else.
And kind of by way of introduction, Eric is out of the history department. On November the 1st, I asked him to become interim dean of the graduate school, and I assured him it would be a piece of cake. It ain't really turned out that way, but I hope I have a shred of credibility left with him. But Eric has certainly built a whole lot of credibility for himself. He's brought a lot of energy, a lot of imagination to the graduate school. He really has been a dynamic presence in a very short period of time. And Dr. Birch had suggested that maybe we might have a word or two about graduate tuition. I realize that's not exactly as exciting as WKU versus Vanderbilt, but it is important to us in some significant ways, and I did ask Eric to say a few words about that by way of introducing that topic this morning.
Thank you, and nice to meet some of you. Dr. Birch, I appreciate the very broad assignment that you gave me, which was philosophy of tuition pricing and how do we compare to, you didn't really say, but I took that as kind of a challenge, and it was quite revealing in a lot of ways. First of all, what is our philosophy of tuition pricing? I think it's safe to say that we have an academic mission, and we need resources to meet that mission. And so the two go hand in hand, don't they? We have to offer great graduate programs. We have to generate adequate resources to fulfill them. But we also have some other missions that are tied into both of those, one of which is that we have a responsibility to our fellow Kentuckians to maintain access to our graduate programs if they're qualified to participate in them. And so that in some ways accounts for our differential tuition structure at the graduate level, where we, well, I'll show you some of that in just a few minutes. One of the other things that shapes the way we price our tuition is the students that that we have, the different student audiences that we are trying to attract and that we're serving. Really have different profiles. You're probably very familiar with our domestic students and the kinds of generic profile of someone who is taking classes part-time as a working professional. Our domestic students tend to be excellent shoppers, looking for certain programs and certain disciplines, and they're willing to shop around to find good prices on their programs, as well as faculty that interest them. One of the things at the graduate level is that there's much more of a connection between the program faculty and the students that they are trying to attract and that are in the programs than perhaps at the undergraduate level, because there's so much more mentorship at the graduate level. One of the other things, domestic students tend to be dependent upon loans and assistantships to help pay for their education. International students, on the other hand, seem to be somewhat less sensitive to the higher tuition that they pay, but they take classes full-time, face-to-face, as part of the visa requirements, and they often come here using their family resources, in other words, money from families that are helping to support them in their home, from their home countries. Here's some information. We can maybe come back to this if you're interested on our four main tuitions, resident, domestic, non-resident, international, and our distance learning fees. And this gives you a flavor of how they've changed over time. Past 4 years. And again, I'm happy to come back to these in a little while if you have questions about them. One of the things that we were asked to do, and I want to thank Scott Gordon, who did an excellent job of putting together the data and finding out what the information was about this, was to compare our pricing, our tuition pricing, to other schools. And so we looked at all of our benchmarks, as well as different Kentucky, all the Kentucky schools that are similar to us. And what I found, the outcome of it to be quite reassuring. One of the one of my most important jobs, but it also is very difficult for me, is sitting with students who are having great difficulty paying for their education. And of course, they complain that it's too expensive, and any student would complain that, and I really have a good feeling for that. But we're actually quite well positioned, as far as I can tell. If you compare the way we charge tuition, our tuition rates, to our benchmarks, to similar schools, the residential rate, the non-residential rate, are very much in the middle, not too high, not too low, compared to other schools. We do have an international tuition rate, which is something that's very unusual. Not many schools have a specific international student rate. They tend to have just a non-resident rate that they charge to anyone who's not in their state.
Is that a good thing or bad thing?
Well, I think it works well. We've used it as a pretty good recruiting tool, and it took me a while to learn about why it's effective. What we do, the way we do our international rate, is that for students who are sponsored by a government, such as Saudi students or students from Oman, who have the resources to pay the full tuition, they pay the full tuition, and we benefit from that. Students who just apply here as independent students have a scholarship that is automatically awarded to them that prices them down to the out-of-state or non-resident tuition rate. And that has turned out to be quite a good recruiting tool, that scholarshipping. Even though it costs us money, you might say, it allows us to capture the student and bring them here and get them in our classroom. The students themselves can actually use those scholarship promises from Western to get loans in their home countries, which it makes it easier for them to do that. So it's actually quite an effective tool. And there are very few of our rates where you can really see a direct connection between enrollment and pricing or scholarshiping. And the international one it's really been a very steady, if not growing, enrollment over the past several years.
Is the automatic tuition rate is only accorded to students that don't come on scholarship programs from their country? The rate is only accorded to individual students who do not come from...
If they're not sponsored by their own...
If they're not sponsored. People under sponsorship do not get that benefit.
That's right. And again, the students who are coming here on sponsored programs are really not paying themselves anyway. So they're already having... They're sponsored, as it were. So I feel less guilt charging them, you might say, the full rate. And again, I'm happy to talk about some of these rates if you wish. But generally speaking, we don't want to think of tuition just as a mechanism to get students here. We want to think about the ways that it's tied into the academic mission. It's true that we can attract students here by using lots of creative means, such as scholarshipping them or coming up with special tuition rates for certain target audiences and that sort of thing. And one of the outcomes of this study that Scott helped put together was that a lot of schools have very creative tuition structures to help them attract students. One thing we do at the undergraduate level, but not at the graduate level, for example, is geographic consideration for tuition or for tuition pricing. Certainly we could look at Ohio or Indiana and consider doing some kind of geographic thing. But the other part of it is that we can use tuition, I think, in ways that serve, that would make WKU a better school, a better academic school, by serving perhaps the students who are already here in kind of interesting ways, creating incentives through tuition pricing to keep students enrolled in a greater number of credit hours so that they complete their degrees more quickly, so that they maintain matriculation rather than come to school for a semester, work for a semester, and so forth. So I really think there are some interesting opportunities, but I would echo something that Dr. Meredith said. He used the analogy of a battleship. It was an aircraft carrier. I was thinking more along the lines of Spinal Tap and that volume control on the amp, the guitar amp. But it takes a long time for different strategies to go into effect, and you really have to take sort of a multi-year approach and think about the ways that tuition pricing is tied to academic programs. Because at the graduate level, the academic programs themselves have to be involved in the process because of issues of capacity of these programs, issues of accreditation standards. You can't just start, turn the volume up or down on the tuition knobs in order to get students in. It's a more complex formula than that, and it takes a lot of real intentional long-term planning. But thank you for your attention. I'm glad to talk a little bit more about this if you'd like.
I've had a few international graduate students express the concern to me that there are some scholarships that have been reduced for them, that they may have been promised, and it's not as much as they anticipated, particularly this year. Has there been a reduction in scholarships for international graduate students?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year, the automatic tuition scholarship number was $200 per credit hour. This year, it's $146 per credit hour. But that's in part a function of the fact that I don't have this up there anymore, but that the non-resident tuition rate changed as well. So, essentially, it's meant to scholarship in between the difference between those two tuition rates. And so when those changed, the amount of the scholarship changed as well.
the notion of the graduate tuition rate structure devised to generate revenues to sustain quality graduate programs, your introductory statement. I know it's complicated. It's complicated because after you deduct the $146, then you have this much differential, roughly $100 more than a residential. It's also complicated because of the added cost of recruiting international students that we don't really have with most of our other graduate students. Do you have any idea of the extent to which international students graduate or are on assistantships? I mean, what portion of them are on assistantships, and what are our actual recruiting? I mean, what kind of recruiting costs are we incurring? Are they stabilizing? Are they going up as we have to pay more to recruit those students, or are we finding other ways of doing it? Okay. I just want to make sure you had an assignment for the future, Eric. But I don't mean to. I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm asking it mainly because of the fact as you look at the changes in the enrollment categories for international students, a number of those are in the categories that come with support from their countries, which means that we have less of a cost involved in getting those students here than the others. So I do think it's something worth looking at just as a way of figuring out where is that going to leave us down the road. Are we going to be able to sustain the degree of support that we now give as the composition of those students changes and the cost of getting them here changes?
Well, one thing I would say about that is that we don't really have a lot to offer graduate students, no matter what you're talking about, whether they're domestic or international, much assistance other than a merit-based academic assistant, graduate assistantship, or one of these small number of, say, the international automatic scholarship. There's not much out. There's no such thing as need-based aid other than government loans at the graduate level. And certainly there's something to be considered there, but it would have to be something very intentional and planned out to be persistent over a long term, because as Mr. Richie pointed out, students are very sensitive to abrupt changes in tuition pricing and scholarshiping, and that's not just international students. It's domestic students as well.
I would be remiss, but I see a lot more graduate students advising than I do undergraduate these days. But I think one of the things historically, and I know Dr. Mansfield would agree to this, that we've had the hardest making significant improvement in graduate assistantships. I mean, we've got some great graduate programs. Some of them are destination point types of programs, but we really have made minimal progress in being able to have assistantships that will attract graduate students. And in the long haul, if we're going to do anything more, we're going to have to figure out how to deal with it. And the second thing is that it's really tough, including residential, in-state graduate students. Sources of funding for graduate students are tough to come by, and I'm convinced that we do have a lot of people that sit by the wayside just because they cannot afford that. I mean, $500 and some odd an hour, credit hour, is not high when you consider what you're getting, and if you were going to go buy a new car, for example, but it's high on some of the salaries that our students make. So I think those are two things we're going to have to figure out. One third thing, okay, that I've become so aware of. We're getting, I noticed on the chart, we're getting more of our international students also from countries where they can't go home again. And I think one of our challenges is going to be, I just didn't know how much I didn't know about that, but I think our challenge is going to be what do we do to help those students have a future as a result of their work at Western? Because if you can't go home again, the opportunities for jobs and employment have to factor into the experiences we give them. I think this is going to be part of our continuing recruiting efforts, what we do.
Just highlight something, the second point you said, you're singing my tune there. When I came into this position, sort of volume, the amount of money that the graduate school had as a whole to devote to graduate assistantships, which are merit-based, not need-based, but merit-based, had declined about 20% over the previous 3 years. It's been, thankfully, the same since I've been working with Dr. Lee, and that's great. But there's a lot more we could be doing for graduate assistantships.
Okay. Well, I thank Dr. Reed for the presentation, and I found it fascinating that there were so many different structures, and I'm intrigued by the fact that you think we could find ways to improve the educational experience through some of this. So go get them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the business of the Academic Affairs Committee.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Break, anyone, or are you ready to charge on? Break. Charge. I got a charge. We got Cynthia rules. So we charge on. Okay. Chair Ridley, would you take student affairs?
Informational items. Our intercultural student engagement, Ms. Martha Sales, is with us today to make a presentation concerning our portion of student affairs. So I'm going to turn it over to her.
Good morning. I'm excited, actually thrilled to spend time with you this morning talking about two major programmatic initiatives and units within the Division of Student Affairs that focus on retention, recruitment, and assisting our students to graduation. I have with me Dr. Martha Sales, who is the Executive Director of the Intercultural Student Engagement Center and the Director of our TRIO programs. Dr. Sales, I am so thrilled to be able to share with you that in her time here at WKU, Dr. Sales has brought over $8 million in external grants to the institution. So we are excited to have her in the Division of Student Affairs. So, Dr. Sales?
Thank you. Good morning. It is a pleasure being here. I'm actually going to start talking with you today first about the TRIO programs. These programs are federally funded. We are housed in the luxurious building of Jones Jaggers Hall. Dr. Ransdell is where we're located. Everyone under the TRIO umbrella is 100% grant funded, as Dr. Holland mentioned. We have 7 TRIO programs here. We have 4 pre-college programs, Upper BAM. We have 3 educational talent search programs or talent search programs. We have 1 adult serving program, that is our Educational Opportunity Center. And then we have 1 veterans serving program, our Veterans Upward Bound program. And we have a student support services program. They serve our WKU students. So again, we have 7 TRIO projects here. We were just fortunate enough to receive the new Educational Talent Search Program, or Talent Search Program, to serve Barron County and Simpson County. Our TRIO programs are located in 10 counties. You know, we have 27 individuals who are full-time. They go into our communities, those 10 counties, as well as 21 middle schools and high schools weekly and monthly to provide college access services and college preparation for our high school and middle school students. For student support services, we serve 225 Western Kentucky University students. With that program, those students have to be enrolled at the host institution. So I just wanted to share a little information with you about our WKU TRIO programs in terms of how many students we serve and funding. Currently this year, just in 2015, because we received those 3 proposals or funds, or grant proposals were funded, I should say, and one of our Educational Opportunity Centers programs was funded, a little bit over $2 million just this year. For our pre-college programs, in 2015, if we look at the class of 2015, 43% of our students enrolled at WKU, okay, or 81 students. For our Veterans Upward Bound program, 92 students, or 76% of the students we serve, veterans participants, enrolled at WKU. For our Educational Opportunity participants, 166 of those participants, or 16%, enrolled at WKU. And then if we look at our Student Support Services, 193 students persisted, or 86.2% persisted at WKU. And then 80% of our Student Support Service participants achieved satisfactory academic progress, or they're in good standing. And again, these students, the demographic of these students, they are first-generation, low-income, minority, underrepresented students. And so what does that mean for WKU? It means just in the fall of 2015, approximately 532 of our students enrolled at WKU full-time. And if you multiply that, Dr. Birch, by a year tuition of $9,482, just tuition alone, TRIO brought about a little bit over $5 million to WKU in 1 year. And we are five-year funded programs. And again, population we serve, first generation, low income, underrepresented, often underprepared students. So TRIO works, and it works well. Any questions about TRIO before we move over to our Intercultural Student Engagement Center?
Our university that I think people know about.
Yes.
Yes. You've had some great mentors.
Yes.
Over the years.
Yes.
Would you expand just a touch on the five-year funding?
Yes.
I think that's important when you mentioned about the numbers. $5 million is a lot of money.
Yes.
Tuition, but also the five-year progress.
Yes. TRIO, grant writers, we have to write for TRIO you are five-year funded, but we are constantly writing. So I'm preparing to write for our Upward Bound programs. Under the umbrella of Upward Bound, we have Upward Bound, Veterans Upward Bound, hoping for a McNair program. A lot of people don't know that Ron McNair, McNair Scholar, that's a TRIO program for PhD completion, enrollment and completion. Also, Veterans Upward Bound falls under the umbrella of Upward Bound, as well as Upward Bound Math Science. And so I'm writing every year for a different project. Once awarded, we are funded for 5 years. And so a base TRIO program is $240,000 per year, and then you multiply that by five. So we are funded for 5 years. So once we're... Yes.
Mr. Bailey, yes. It's probably one of the most ulcerating positions you can have being TRIO, because if you've got many programs, it means you are constantly writing to get one or more of them refunded. It's just a constant process, and it's amazing. I don't know how many years this institution's had TRIO.
Since 1981.
Thank you. Okay. But there have been millions of dollars come to us for TRIO, and so it's pretty remarkable that we've had that many successful people.
Well, personally, I think that we're all indebted to being able to work with the veterans.
Yes.
That is a huge pool of individuals that need to be built, and there are other programs on campus that are also assisting to teach kids and so forth, and nationally we've been recognized for those things. So your numbers,
yes,
representing the Upward Bound program for veterans, I think should, and maybe we should try to figure out how we can promote that a little more. Because a lot of this, I'm sure, is very new for a lot of folks.
Yes, and we are fortunate because we are the only Veterans Upward Bound in the state of Kentucky housed at Western Kentucky University.
Once again,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. The only one.
And this is staff, correct?
Yes.
So the staff members have brought in the over $8 million because the ones doing the grant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. 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 Professional staff. Yes. Thank you. Yes. 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 Good point. Yes. Any other questions?
I think it's amazing the numbers that are coming here, because if I recall, one of the stipulations of TRIO is that you cannot recruit for your own institution. You're not allowed to recruit your students. You're only able to take those first generation kids and help them get ready and want to go further. But if you end up recruiting for your own, you're kind of in trouble. So
yes.
they have to be doing something right for them to want to come here without being directly recruited in a TRIO program. It's not a recruitment program. It's a getting ready, first generation.
Yes. I think it's the relationships we build.
Mm-hmm.
I think because we're in the schools every month, Upper Bound is in the schools every week, the counselors trust us. Parents, we develop relationships mm-hmm. with parents, and parents know who we are. And students will find you once you have helped a student, starting mm-hmm. from the sixth grade with our talent search and assisting them on graduating. They will find you. Their mamas will find you. If they have questions, they will contact us. And I think it's the relationships that we've built, not only with the families, but also with the school and the administration.
TRIO is also built on, I guess it's going to be a good precursor for us as we get into performance-based funding, because it's
yes.
you've had to show the numbers that you get. I mean, you've had to show actual numbers to get your next grant.
Yes.
For
a person, for a little point of clarity, the area then is basically Commonwealth of Kentucky, or do we bleed over into some of the counties in Tennessee where we have reciprocation, tuition assistance, and so forth?
Our grants, we identify target areas, so we only identify 10 counties that we serve. TRIO is national, and so we do have some programs in Tennessee and in every state, but for our grant, we only serve 10 counties.
Is there collaboration between the groups that
yes.
allow
yes.
you to...
Yes,
you
know, we have state...
Tennessee, for example.
Yes, we have state organization, a regional organization. In our regional organization, there are 8 states, and then we have a national TRIO organization.
And that would allow us to... I'm playing off what yes. Bert said. You can't recruit your students, can we recruit
yes.
your associates?
Yes, and oftentimes... other universities or other TRIO program staff will call us and say we want to have a tour at WKU, but the time is not good for our admissions office, so will you all provide us a tour? So Jace has provided us with scripts where when students come, we can, our TRIO personnel, our staff people take those other individuals and those schools on tour.
That's marvelous. Cooperation.
Yes.
Departments, I think.
Yes.
Bridge those issues. And
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Let's move on then to
the Intercultural Student Engagement Center. We are excited about this initiative as well, or this new program, division, unit, team, Dr. Ransdale. We have moved from just an office that provides programming at West Kentucky University, but we are focused now on recruitment, retention, and graduation of students to assist those students. We're located in Downing University Union, room 2041. I think you guys will be there next month to see our new facility. And I guess I should ask, do you all have any questions before I want to see maybe what your thoughts are about the Intercultural Student Engagement Center, or do you have any?
I think one of the things that is important here is we've evolved.
Yes.
We created a Black Cultural Center, and when Lynn became our Chief Diversity Officer, our Dean of Students and Chief Diversity Officer, she had a bigger idea, a more inclusive idea, and an idea that I found exciting. So kind of walk us through that transition and why an Intercultural Student Engagement Center is a better approach for the kind of embracement cohesiveness we're trying to instill on our campus, and how this center is a primary means through which that can be achieved.
What we desire to do is be a place or office that connects education, students, and culture. and also education, community, and culture. Education, faculty, and staff, and culture. And I think the word you used earlier this week, embracing, while encouraging, while directing. Sometimes students don't know what they don't know. So we want to have an office where students can come and communicate and talk, but also remind them that they are students. And so we want to make sure they are retained and they graduate and get a job and keep it so they can take care of me when I retire. That's really why I'm so kind to students. and so we want to provide that platform, that venue where we can communicate, where we can embrace and not be intimidated while doing so. And again, constantly reminding students that you are a student.
So the difference between a Black cultural center and an intercultural student engagement center would be?
Yes. If you look at the history of Black cultural centers or minority student support services centers or offices for diversity program, those are models that worked very well in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, creeping into the 90s. As we've become far more of a global society, one of the things that we realize is that we must figure out ways to engage with each other with civil discourse, with kindness and compassion. And so many of the things that we learned when we were much younger, now we have an opportunity to practice. The Intercultural Center is not just going to focus on students of color. It will also focus on our majority student populations so that we can figure out how to engage with each other and to do it civilly. So although we have an incredible component that is a Black cultural center, but it is embedded within the Intercultural Student Engagement Center so that we can assist students, students of color, and also majority students in persisting to graduation. So we are using the TRIO model, the student success model of TRIO, which has an incredible emphasis on shepherding students through, mentoring, guiding, providing them with the resources that they need, assisting them with learning self-efficacy skills, assisting them in learning the skill set that is required in order to be successful in the classroom, placing that within the Black Cultural Center, embedded in the Intercultural Students Engagement Center, and using those strategies to assist that student population, but then also our larger student population as well. Because that element of human dynamics is so incredibly important. And when we think about this institution and its foci for the last several years on increasing our international student demographic, that is also a student population that we must be able to engage with in positive ways in order for us to be successful here in the state of Kentucky. There are several other things. The CPE, of course, for the last couple of years has been focusing on cultural competence. Well, many times when you begin talking about cultural competence or intercultural competence, most folks have a dazed look in their face, and they begin to ask that question, well, what in the world is that? On its face is, how do we become individuals who can engage with other individuals without fear, with confidence, with respect, again, with those things that we learn when we are at our parents' knee? So, questions?
It reminds me of the book Cultural Literacy and the big wave that caused 20 years ago.
Yes.
So, and how that's changed and what you're saying.
Yes.
Is very
Even
much
though
needed.
We're about this, the student and this focus, if you look at the recent announcement in economic development within our region, we are reaching other cultures that we may or may not have had a relationship with within this area.
Correct.
So the real boots on the ground, well, that's a bad word, but the real feet on the ground is the the ability to develop this at a younger age rather than taking a population that has set in a particular fashion and mold and shape them to fit the economy of the future.
Yes. And thank you for bringing that up, because that was the other point, too, that escaped me there for a moment. In addition to the cultural competence amongst ourselves in an educational setting, it is something that our employers are demanding.
Yes.
Because, yes, the company may be located in Scottsville, Kentucky. However, its headquarters are in Beijing. And how do we figure out ways to engage with each other when our employer may not be a domestic individual? What is that going to look like for our students? So there are multiple pieces to this puzzle with the Intercultural Student Engagement Center that will assist us in retaining our students, but also helping them to be productive citizens as they leave us as well.
TikTok, I think maybe you have.
Yes. I have two questions.
Sure.
What is the main difference between ISAC and the Office of Institutional Diversity and Inclusion that we formerly had?
Well, because I was not involved much with the office of the OIDI office, I really can't speak to that. I can speak to what the Intercultural Student Engagement Center is going to focus on, but I cannot speak to what OIDI was their foci, not with any degree of accuracy.
Sure. And follow-up question, will our students who are members of the LGBTQIA plus community receive institutional support from ISAC?
Most definitely, as they have done so in the past. And I'm certainly not ready to announce this yet, but I guess in speaking about it, I guess I am announcing it. Just in the past few weeks, I have been engaging with our LGBTQ plus student population, and we have been able to create a pride center in our Garrett Conference Center. It's a small space. We're working on the nuances, but this was also a goal when I assumed the role of CDO. This was a goal that we wanted to make sure that we were able to create that. So it's in rough. Mm-hmm. It's very rough right now. However, Intercultural Student Engagement Center will have oversight function for our Pride Center. However, please keep that secret because it's still very rough.
Just one follow-up. Thank you for that. That's very helpful to know. And just one follow-up question to that. Will it be – that's extremely exciting news. Will it be a dedicated space? I assume it will be. Will it also be funded, or will it just be a space? Will it be under ISAC?
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And the physical location of this, I think we went past that. We're not at Jones Jaggers. That is
no correct. That correct.
DSU 2041.
DSU.
Yes.
It's a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I am really proud of it.
That's good.
And
well,
I
you had mentioned your location. I
yes.
Just wanted to make sure everyone knew
yeah.
that this was a not. At
well, that'll be part of our agenda at our October board meeting to go there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, lovely. Great. Please.
And I just want to comment because, one, I'm privileged to be able to teach in the organization leadership, which, by the way, was the fastest growing major in master's degree. But I teach face-to-face class, so I've got the international students. And I was very excited when I saw about the Intercultural Student Engagement Center, and I want to make sure my students know about that as well. But, I mean, I have students from Vietnam, China, Madagascar, Iraq, and the U.S., and I hope I didn't miss a country there. But it's so amazing to be able to talk, and we're trying to do that within the classroom. I try to do it within the class to, you know, have everybody work together and learn, and that intercultural aspect of the class is just amazing, and we're sharing, and the students are able to share so much, and I absolutely look forward to the, you know, the Tuesday night classes to be able to do that, and I'm very excited about this program that you're doing, and want to make and definitely make sure they know about it and that they can use that as a resource. So,
and if you would like to host one of your classes on Tuesday night in our area,
I could do that.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions? Yes, Barb.
First of all, I really want to congratulate you, Lynn, on the courage to not create more silos, which I think what you're doing is moving to bringing it together in a way that it should. I think this is really a good move. And I also think that we probably are unique as an institution in taking advantage of some of what has worked in the TRIO model. I think that's a good thing. And the last comment is that what a wonderful challenge to figure out how to somehow make all of this connect with all the other things that are on this campus to support students. This is about students, and I think it's exciting. Thank you.
Any other questions? I have been informed by one of my bosses, Julia McDonald, that we are going to break now. Where is she?
Here.
Right, is this correct? Would you?
Yeah, it's okay. We need to go ahead and break. You all can do your business, and then we'll have a quick tour and lunch, so we can switch out some technical support.
And when we return, we have the pleasure of information about the Student Government Association. Our regent, J. Todd Ritchie, will be bringing in some folks, I think. Is that correct?
Beautiful.
And so we look forward to that after our break and our lunch. So
we're gonna
tour,
if
I think.
You all can take a break and meet back in here in, say, 10 minutes. Then Dr. Breedlove will be here to welcome and give a brief tour, and then we'll do the lunch. Yes, because we've got to do some switching out of equipment.
Right.